Inconceivable!
Hey, Doc, we better back up. We don't have enough road to get up to 88. Roads?
And welcome again to the Good Trash Genre Cast, where some guys get together around a table and they talk about movies in a analytical, film theory informed, sociological kind of way. But we don't look at those high films. We're not doing any go dah. You know, we're not going to do
it. Sorry, what did you just say?
Go dah. You got to hawk on it like
that. Was it like it's a Klingon word?
A Klingon Godard.
Okay.
Right. We don't do that.
I would watch a Klingon Godard film. That's awesome.
It would be kind of awesome. No, we watch genre movies.
We do.
And so we're here.
A little less Godard and a little more Goddard.
Right. That's how we roll. Drew.
Specifically. You know.
So, welcome again. We're so glad that you are here. My name is Dustin Sells. I am still a grad student in 20th and 21st century studies with a film emphasis. At the University of Central Oklahoma. To my left.
My name is Dalton Stewart. I recently obtained a Bachelor of Arts in Sociology from the University of Central Oklahoma, and I like to watch the movies.
To my right, we have no one.
An empty chair. We left it open for Eli.
Mr. Arthur Gordon is otherwise entangled and engaged.
That was a Jewish reference.
To for Elijah, though.
Well, I said, damn it, I messed it up. I failed.
So, anyway, we are glad to be here, even though we're slightly short-staffed, to talk about a little movie called God Bless America.
God Bless America, indeed. I'm sad that Arthur's not here,
though. I you know what?
It's his birthday.
It is his birthday, so I'm not sad, because, you know, if he had to spend his birthday here with us, that would be more sad.
I spent my birthday with you guys.
Oh, I just, you know, my heart melted a little on the inside.
Also, he's, you know, above 21. What the hell is he celebrating? Hooray, you're still alive! I guess.
Well, that's nice.
The alternative is being dead.
Right.
So.
Congratulations. You've traveled around the sun again.
Happy birthday, Arthur. That's what we're saying.
Yes.
In a very roundabout way.
That's what we mean to say. Anyhow, we're going to talk about God Bless America. It's a little movie directed by Mr. Bobcat Goldthwait. He is of Police Academy fame. Mr. Zed, I believe, was the character.
I believe is the character's name. Also, one of my favorite 80s movies. Gosh, I can't. One Crazy
is
Summer?
I don't know. It's your favorite, not mine.
Oh, my God. I can't remember the name. It's got Demi Moore and John Cusack. It's got a weird title. That's why I can't remember the name of it. Oh, you know what? It's called One Crazy Summer is what it's called. The plot is just, you know, standard 80s movie comedy, but it's just really funny. You should check it out. It's a good flick. I like it.
Okay.
So that's a thing he did other than, you know, Police Academy.
Pretty much. Thank you, Roscoe the Dog, also with us. I hope
chiming in. He's a big fan of the film.
And
also, you know, lest we ignore it, other than his recent fairly successful directing career, Mr. Goldthwait also has a long and illustrious career doing stand-up. So
he's a funny man. He is not in the movie, though. He's directing it. And so let's move on and let's do a synopsis without the voice of the cinema. Rather, we're going to have the voice of... You know, free television.
The dollar theater. I'm going to do my palest intent. I'm going to try.
You're going to do it? Okay.
I'm going to try.
You're going to do it like Bobcat?
No, God. Blah, blah,
blah. No?
No.
No?
No. You want?
No.
You want to say in a world?
In a world.
That's terrible. What was that?
That was Bobcat.
No, wasn't it? It sounded like Donald.
Yeah, I mean, just going to throw some stuff
if
in.
If any of us could do Bobcat, that's how we do it. Sadly,
none of
you're
going
to get me doing my best voice of the cinema. On a mission to rid society of its most repellent citizens, terminally ill Frank makes an unlikely accomplice in 16-year-old Roxy.
Well, that's a terrible synopsis.
It's really not a good synopsis at all.
Not at all. And furthermore, I think you sounded more like we should go to a monster truck rally.
Sunday, one time only, Grave Digger and I don't know any other monster trucks.
Bigfoot.
Okay.
He said, okay. Fantastic. Well, dear listener, the movie, if I could further synopsize, because of this hideous synopsis.
It's really not a good one.
Guy watches TV and sees some reality television and realizes the world has become kind of crazy and stupid and rude.
A cesspool of bullshit.
And furthermore, he finds out he has brain cancer and decides, hey, you know what? I am going to kill all these terrible, rude people. In the meantime, he meets a 16-year-old girl. They do a Bonnie and Clyde thing. And
but, you know, not without the...
Without the, yeah.
Slightly more platonic. Actually, they mentioned that.
I think completely platonic.
Platonic
Bonnie and Clyde is actually a phrase that is used at one point.
And it culminates at a major event, and I will probably say no more. I don't think there's any need to spoil that particular.
Yeah, we don't have to, yeah.
And on that, so, I mean, for analysis.
Normally we don't care, but yeah, you know, if we don't have to, we won't.
Yeah, so we'll avoid that. But let's do what we always do, which is discuss just if we like it, if we don't like it, does it work, does it not work? Thumbs up, thumbs down, and then we'll move on to what we're really about, which is analysis. This is not a review show, this is an analysis show. So, moving on. Mr. Dalton Stewart, what say you?
I dug it. I did. I don't think all the jokes land, and I think it starts to run out of steam towards the end, and it definitely takes a predictable, you know, dark point where, oh, they broke up. Oh, they got back together triumphantly. I mean, but that's how all movies about two people go.
Yeah, those
I mean,
road trip pretty much. Movies. Yeah.
Road trip, buddy, cop. I mean, any pairing of two people, there's going to be falling out or, you know, a reunion. But, you know, For what it is, I think Bobcat does a good job of kind of airing his grievances against society. And you know, I think the film works. It's very dark, but if you're into that kind of thing, it's pretty funny. Like I said, some of the jokes don't always land, but, you know, there's some fun stuff in here. I do want to point out the opening voiceover from Joel Murray. Really solid. I think it really sets the tone. It's very funny. And yeah, I think it really sets the tone for this film. It is this kind of sardonic, slant-eyed glance over its shoulder look at what's behind it, which is the wasteland that is what I would call the vast majority of American popular culture. You know, not the vast majority, but a lot of this, particularly broadcast television,
yeah.
I think. And reality shows in general, I mean, I think there's some other targets. No pun intended with the, you know, mm-hmm. nature of this film. But I think there are some other popular culture targets that are being looked at. And it's not just popular culture. I think in a lot of ways it is the way people behave. But we'll get more on that later. I do want to point out that a frequent voice comes up through the film, and that is Tom Kenny, the voice of SpongeBob SquarePants. He's also one of the co-workers who gets shot in Joel's fantasy towards the beginning of the film. But the radio announcer is one of the, when he's listening to the kind of crappy morning talk
mm-hmm.
show,
mm-hmm.
one of the voices of SpongeBob. He also is of the voice of a commercial earlier in the film. Huh. Yeah, I was just like, that's funny. I also had a thought that Alice Cooper must not own the rights to his own music, knowing what I know about him in real life.
Mm-hmm.
Because in real life, it's my understanding that Cooper's kind of a little right wing, surprisingly.
I don't know if he is politically or not.
I know he's kind of conservative. He's, you know, he's old man.
Yeah.
You know, so it was weird to hear all the Alice Cooper music in a film that I definitely don't think he'd be okay with. And well, maybe in the '70s. I think now he's kind of mellowed in his old age. He seems to not really be into that whole thing anymore.
Hmm.
From what I know about what he does. My point is, just those were some things I thought at, or I noticed during the film. I do want to say it's just, you know, the budget shows in places, particularly in what are big set piece type moments that I think the film wanted to do more with. Particularly the climax of the film and then parts of the road trip scene. But overall, it worked for me. I don't think it's a masterpiece by any means, but I think it definitely has some interesting things to say, and I think overall it does them fairly well.
All right, very good. I don't know if I want to give a thumb down or a thumb sideways. I mean, I'm about that ambivalent
yeah.
about it because I get the violence. I get how the violence is being used as a punchline.
Yeah.
But unlike Fargo, where it's hilarious when the leg is going in the wood chipper,
mm-hmm.
it's just like, oh, there's something hurtful in my reaction.
To this violence.
To this movie, yeah.
I will say that the violence train sort of runs out of steam.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say around the midpoint.
I think around the first 5 minutes.
Really?
When they throw up the baby like a clay pigeon and shoot it.
Okay, for the record, if you didn't actually watch this movie, that doesn't technically happen. It's a dream sequence. I don't want you to... Lest you think...
Well, none of it actually happens. It's a movie.
I know. But I think it speaks to Joel Murray's character of Frank that he wouldn't actually shoot a baby. He'd shoot the baby's parents, probably. But he wouldn't actually shoot a baby.
Well, he wouldn't.
And I literally wrote, whoa. One word, whoa, in my notes when I saw that. And laughed. I pretty hard, I'm not going to lie. That was... I was definitely a shock laugh if there ever was one.
Yeah.
But I think the audacity of it is quite, and then just the fade to his happy, pleasant face, upset by the crying of the baby to let you know he did not, in fact, shoot the baby like a clay pigeon, which, I love that the mother throws the baby in the, there's a lot of, like, really funny sight gags in this film. The dialogue's fairly funny, but, I get what you're saying. I get what you're saying about violence. I think the joke held its own longer for me. I think it did run out of steam eventually, but not the first 5 minutes.
It seemed to me that it somewhat became hateful. Now, it redeemed itself. You know, the Office Place Massacre was a bit hilarious.
Which one was that? I'm sorry.
The Office Place Fantasy Massacre.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Where it turns out he's shooting the stapler.
Right.
Yes.
Which was quite a bit hilarious. Shades of Office Space came
yes.
to mind.
Oh, certainly.
And so that was fine and fun and whatnot. But I think Bobcat's right.
Yes.
Let's say that. I think Bobcat's right.
Mm-hmm.
Something's wrong with society. And that's legitimate. And that's fine. However, it seems that he fails to be very endearing or ironic. And I think that's, again, the word I used earlier was hateful, and hateful may be a little strong, but it's certainly abrasive.
Well, and I think the saving grace of this film is, clearly Frank is an author surrogate
mm-hmm.
for Bobcat Goldthwait's opinion. I mean, that's pretty obvious. I mean, specifically the way in which Frank, either in voiceover or to groups of people in the film, but more realistically to the audience, in many ways you're seeing the writer directly address the audience, I think. And I think that's where you redeem is in this really soulful performance from Joel Murray.
Mm-hmm.
I think
mm-hmm.
he knocks out of the park, and I think that's what makes him endearing.
It is a good performance.
I think Roxy is meant to represent what you're talking about, is this hateful side of things, about how this, if you're not looking at it through the right lens, if your indictment of society becomes too bitter and too anarchic,
we're going to kill everyone who high fives.
Exactly.
For instance.
And
Mr. Dalton Stewart will be dead 5,000 times because he has many times on this program high fived a thousand angels.
I love a high five. I love a good high five. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? When you make eye contact with the elbow and it just slams. Ah, it's the best. It's just, I'm sorry. I hate American Idol for what it's worth. shoot me, please. My point is, I think I get what you're saying, and I think in many ways the sadness in
mm-hmm.
Frank is the redeeming factor, is what
it
keeps
is.
It from being too bitter.
But again, it's the Roxy character, because she tempers it too much. And I
think that's part of her arc, is understanding what Frank is actually about. And likewise, Frank understanding that popular culture does not represent society as a whole, does not represent everyone
right.
alive, that he isn't alone, and that we are, in fact, a society of good people at the end of the day, I think, for the most part.
Well, and I think you're right. It's a little softer than perhaps my experience was. I will say this, before we move on to analysis,
mm-hmm.
is this idea that Frank talks about people, though, who deserve to die.
Uh-huh.
You know, as repugnant as Simon Cowell is, the guy from American Idol,
yes,
he doesn't deserve
no.
to die. And therein lies
I understand.
Some of that hatefulness.
I get what you're saying.
So,
picking up. But before we move on, I do want to make a note of something that I listened to an interview with Bobcat Goldthwait recently on a podcast I mentioned on this show, You Made It Weird with Pete Holmes. He did an interview on there. And of all of the weird things, of all of the seemingly controversial things in this film, the only thing he caught any flack for was the comment about Diablo Cody's the only stripper who suffers from too much self-esteem. It's the only thing he got any flack for.
Huh.
And I think it's probably because the only people who saw this movie were people who probably agreed with the thesis.
Probably.
The dogs also agree that, you know, it's a small film. Not a lot of exposure to the kind of people who probably wouldn't like it.
Yeah, I think that's true.
I think that might be part of the problem, and this kind of leads us over to our analysis. Is that Bobcat is he's preaching to the choir.
Yeah.
You know, this is not a movie that's going to reach a wide audience. It's certainly not going to reach the audience that I think needs to hear it. I think it's a little self-congratulatory in some ways. As much as I like this movie, and I do, I don't want to take anything away from it. Because it's smartly written, it's well-directed, I think. So I don't want to take anything away from it, but it is self-congratulatory. It's like, aren't we good for not being assholes, basically? And
mm-hmm.
I think I think there was more hate to go around, honestly. I think there were more segments of our culture that deserved indictment that would actually be seen by the people perpetrating such things. You know what I mean?
I do.
That makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
People who watch American Idol, people who slavishly follow right-wing talking heads for their world information, they're not going to watch God Bless America.
Probably not.
If they ever hear about it, it's only going to be the shocking things that happen in it.
Right.
And that it's, you know, encouraging people to kill others. That's all they'll ever hear. People who are going to watch this movie are movie nerds.
Mm-hmm.
Are comedy people. You know, people who are going to agree with it.
Oh, and lefties.
And left. That's what I was saying. You know, it's people who can appreciate a film and people who are going to agree with the opinions for the most part of this movie. And I think that's part of the problem. I think there are plenty of obnoxious people that are this film's target audience, and they have plenty of obnoxious behaviors that should have been addressed. That's what I'm getting at.
Fair enough.
Let's
move on into analysis, is what I would say, Dalton. What do you bring to the table about that in this film?
Well, as I said, that last kind of comment bleeds over into our analysis. That wasn't really the thought was in my mind, so I wanted to get it out there. But yeah, that wasn't really a thumbs up, thumbs down thing. I think we're starting to look at what is this film about?
Yeah.
I think. And I think there's a couple of key things here. One is this idea of violence as catharsis. Not the act of violence, but the idea of violence as being cathartic.
Enacted violence.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of portrayals of violence or the idea of violence and removing violence, the consequences from violence, while not good and should not be encouraged to let people think that that's the way the real world works, in a lot of ways, it allows for a sense of exhale. And I think that's an interesting thing. I don't really have a lot to say about that, though. What I do want to talk about is this idea of who is responsible for our culture. And I think God Bless America touches on this in a lot of ways, in that our culture is kind of this interesting, you know, dialectic between us as individuals and us as a mass.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting to me that I think there's even a few snippets of dialogue, but not really expanded on, of people talking about what they've seen that Frank detests and mentioning that it is terrible. But isn't it funny? Isn't it funny? And I think it's a very interesting thing that happens where we pretend that a phenomenon comes from nowhere, that it simply exists in and of itself without any feedback from individuals. And I think that's a mistake. I think at the end of the day, the onus of responsibility for what is popular does fall on us as a society. I think, and I'm not trying to get on a soapbox and go watch more independent film, go watch more original ideas. I mean, what I'm saying is...
Yes, go ahead, say that.
Well, I mean, do that.
And watch less junk.
But watch less junk, but I'm not trying to get on a soapbox. If you like junk, that's fine. I mean, there's nothing inherently wrong.
This is kind of a junk show.
Exactly. You know, it's an hour-long podcast where a couple of chuckleheads talk about film. Yeah.
It's genre film. Not Godot.
You know, at the end of the day, it's disposable. But that's okay. And there's nothing wrong with disposable entertainment. What there is wrong with is laughing at people. And that's something Frank talks about. Kicking people while they're down. That's why I don't like to do... You know, we're not a show that does movies that are... You know, we're not going to review The Room or Birdemic. You know, that's not what we're about. I think when a film is that bad and it didn't have a budget, when a movie has a gigantic budget and it's awful, I think you're allowed to laugh. Because these are competent people who are supposed to be professionals failing miserably.
Right.
When somebody, you know, pours their heart and soul and their life savings into something and fails miserably, now you're laughing at, you know, a handicapped kid. You know, which is something Frank makes a mention of when, I forget the character's name, but the clear...
William Hung.
The clear William Hung analog. You know, we have to take responsibility for ourselves. And Frank talks a lot about that. We have to take responsibility for our culture, and we have to be willing to say, that's not okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I do not endorse that. You know, should you die if you watch Keeping Up with the Kardashians or American Idol? No, of course not.
Mm-hmm.
Should you consider what you're consuming, though, and what that means in the bigger scheme of things? Yeah, probably. You know, Dustin said a long time ago, early in the show's history, he had a conversation with someone about you shouldn't read so much into things, and Dustin said, no, you should always talk about things. And look at things. And that's what we're about here. I mean, let's look at things. And I think, you know, everyone should lend the same critical lens that we try to, you know, shed light on some movies, and just at our society in general, we need to be using that same lens and think about what are we watching, what are we endorsing. I think it's important.
By the way, for my rant on things, see the Creepshow episode.
Is it Creepshow?
It was Creepshow episode.
The rant about things. It's a good rant. It's a good rant. You know, and that's really all I have to say. I didn't mean to get up on a soapbox.
No,
and,
I think
route,
it's
but I think
valid.
Bobcat's got a point, man. Mm-hmm. You know, and he's not endorsing violence. Obviously, this film is satire. But you know, it's important to keep in mind what we're about. And at the end of the day, shouldn't we be about being kind to one another? And I think that's what Frank's message is, despite, you know, that message coming at the other end of an AK-47.
Right.
Let's listen to each other. And let's, you know, what's normal?
Mm-hmm.
That's another thing that I thought was interesting was Frank is considered not normal because he doesn't like this garbage.
Right.
And I think that's something I think I've seen a lot is people who, I don't watch that. What? You don't? And it's, no, you know what? Don't judge anybody for what they consume. Judge people for not thinking about what they consume, I think is what I'm saying.
I think that's fair.
Okay. And that's what I've got. I do want to, before we move on, I want to point out, the young actress that plays Roxy is freaking awesome.
She's very good.
She's great. I want to see her in more stuff.
She should act more often.
I think this was her first movie,
mm-hmm.
And she should definitely act more. She's just, I tell you what, she's got some screen presence. That kid, mm-hmm. Kid's got Maxie. You know, she's a heck of a little actress, and I hope she does more things. And Joel Murray, I love from his days on Mad Men and basically everything I've seen him do. So, that's it.
Okay.
I'm done.
Excellent. Well, let me do a little analysis myself. And I'm going to do something more structural, a little bit more formal.
Go for it, man.
And that is the way it is put together as a film, the way it's stitched together. Now, of course, generically, we're seeing the blackest of black comedies, a road movie, and a little bit of Bonnie and Clyde, you know, having a baby, fathered by Bobcat Goldthwait. So,
it's a weird wet nurse.
It's weird. But the movie is structured with these amazing speeches.
It really is.
I mean, I kept thinking about Shakespeare and stage. And those soliloquies, they're not quite soliloquies because they're always spoken to somebody else. And that's what I want to kind of structurally look at for a moment. The very first one is our main character is ranting to his cubicle mate about American Idol and how they don't have talent. They've got pitch.
I love that.
They've got pitch. You know, the karaoke singers. They're not creative musicians. They are something else. Validity of that argument aside, and I think there is a point to be made there, and there is also a point that perhaps some of those people still may be a bit talented. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't want to make a wholesale evaluation there, but I get where he's coming from. And the dude is totally not listening to him.
Yeah.
Totally not hearing a word that he's saying. The next major soliloquy that I noticed was the Alice Cooper speech. Delivered by Roxy.
Which is delightful.
Which is an epic moment.
Which is where also the indictment against Juno and Diablo Cody comes.
Correct.
Which is funny because, let's face it, Roxy does talk a lot like Juno. I mean, he tries to lampshade it, but come on.
Yeah, it's there.
It, you can't deny it.
It is totally there. Very funny.
Hilarious.
Very wonderful, especially if you're an Alice Cooper fan like myself. You know, I feed my Frankenstein anytime. Moving on.
I like Poison a lot. That's a good one.
Well,
Poison on a bed of nails.
It's all good.
AC.
It's Alice Cooper.
AC, man.
We're not worthy. So, that being said, he does that. Also, he gives this speech about the objectification of young girls.
Yes.
You know, and says, you know, forget Vladimir Nabokov, and I about fell off my couch. It's probably the funniest moment of the movie.
It's very funny.
For me personally. Now, what I want to say is that part of the critique of the film, obviously I think there is a lefterly bias in what's going on here. However, I would probably say pundits on the left are equally capable of selective hearing.
Yes.
In conversation, as pundits on the right. Clearly, I don't even remember the dude's name, but he is a Bill O'Reilly.
Analog. Well, analog. I like to think, I kind of thought of him more as a Glenn Beck analog. Okay. He's basically everybody rolled in one.
Okay. Know? Well, I thought more O'Reilly personally, and what I was thinking was how he, there's this segment where he doesn't let the other guy talk, and if you got a response, you can give me that response, but don't give me the response right now because you've got nothing to say. And he kept talking, mm-hmm. to, like, talking at his opponent across the table, mm-hmm. and says, now think about it after the break, and maybe you'll have something intelligent or whatever, yeah. you pinhead, to say. And that's where the O'Reilly comes in, because that's his thing, isn't it, pinhead? And
maybe, who knows?
But that being said, there was this idea that there was no conversation being held there. What I love about what's going on with these other three soliloquies is we see the first one is a complete O'Reilly soliloquy with his cubicle mate.
His do what?
His cubicle mate.
Oh, yes, yes.
Completely an O'Reilly conversation where he's just not hearing and thinking about what he's going to say next and how he's going to quote whatever somebody else said.
Yeah.
You know, instead of thinking on his own, having his own thoughts, there is a Jackie Brown quote. It pleased me.
Wait, there was... Oh, yes,
yes,
there was.
You know,
there was a Jackie Brown quote.
Which was very funny to me.
But yeah, he makes a good point about this idea that everyone speaks in a, and, you know, I catch... I that struck me. Mm-hmm. That resonated with me because we do it on the show sometimes. We speak in what was the word he used? There was a phrase he used. My point is we speak in one-liners. We speak in mm-hmm. catchphrases. That was, people speak in catchphrases. We, you know, we regurgitate things we like in pop culture, and that's supposed to say something about us. And that's something I catch myself doing. That's something I notice a lot of the people of my generation doing. And I think that is the closest you get to an indictment of the people watching this movie.
Yeah, and I think that's worthy of evaluation.
Absolutely.
But the point being, in my analysis, mm-hmm. is the listening. Now we move on, and the Alice Cooper conversation comes up. It's passionate. It's crazy. Logically, does it completely hold water? Maybe, maybe not, even though my love for the Cooper is there. But what's wonderful is that Joel listens to her.
He does.
He hears what she says. And he says something like, fair point, valid, you know, point taken. And that's dialogue. Furthermore, when the Am I Pretty conversation comes up in the thrift store.
Which is probably, I mean, that's just a good bit of
it. It's fantastic.
It's really great character. I love that scene.
He is actually responding to what she's saying, sometimes saying he won't respond.
Yes.
And then finally explaining why he doesn't respond. And even though they end up at loggerheads at the end of the conversation.
They had a conversation.
They had a real legitimate conversation through speeches. And that's what I find to be really interesting. Because rather than just using the catchphrases and the taglines, what they do is they actually enunciate thoughts, paragraphs.
Yeah.
Of words.
Pages, even.
Of words that mean something, that are thoughtful, that are original to the source, and that those words are considered by the other. And for that, I think the movie is kind of brilliant. I mean, more than just a little brilliant. Because I think this
whole discussion... I think you're starting to like this movie more
as conversation.
You're talking.
Well, no, I feel like it's hateful, you know, or it's painful for me to watch. Again, I wish he'd found another vehicle for that rather than just this sort of postal massacre sort of idea to it. So that's the first bit of analysis I bring that I really found interesting about the movie was the use of speech in dialogue. It was like soliloquies in dialogue.
I mean, it's something I definitely noticed, but I didn't even consider it in the same way. I think it's a great... It's something that definitely elevates this film. Obviously, there's too many speeches in this film to ignore. But yeah, it's when you break it down, you've made me realize sitting here, man, that really is, I think, part of what elevates this film. And they're not preachy, and they easily could have been.
They could have been.
Easily. They're just trying to make a point and being reasonable, which is... part of what Joel is rallying against. I say, I keep Joel Mariziak, part of what Frank is rallying against.
Frank's right. I think I did the same thing.
Yeah. Joel's a good name. Also, I've been playing a video game. We'll talk about that later. Sorry.
The other thing I would want to mention is the social commentaries are everywhere. I mean, of course, American Idol, the whole celebrity culture, mm-hmm. the fame, the instant gratification, all of that stuff is pretty valuable. But there is tucked at the very front end of the movie a very male... concern, and I'm curious sociologically as to your thoughts. Where Frank's receptionist, I forget her name.
Yeah, the receptionist.
The receptionist, who is, I clearly as I saw her, I thought attracted to Frank.
Yeah, Yeah.
As she played it, clearly attracted to Frank, and Frank was not doing anything all that creepy or weird.
No.
Having conversation, he handed her a book. She had a bad day. He did violate company procedure and
look up her address.
Look up her address to send her flowers. And I thought to myself, this whole idea of sexual harassment, and I know this is one of those big uglies, but I think the movie touches on that issue.
Yeah.
Because there is this idea or this fear in society that
of each other,
of one another. There's this overregulation of either, you know, the man is fearful to make any sort of advance romantically towards another person.
Likewise, the female is fearful of any romantic advance made against her.
And I find...
Well, towards her. I say towards, against, you know what I mean.
Towards her. And I find that to be problematic.
It is.
And I think that is part of what isolates us further as a society. You know, I mean, you could talk about the text speech and the, you know, zoning in your phone and how that creates this isolated, individuated sort of selfhood in contemporary society. But I think this whole romantic workplace situation is a major problem. And I don't know what to do about it or to suggest about it. And Goldthwait does not give us any answers. But I found it interesting that it was at least brought up.
I think what he's getting at, and, you know, not to have a long conversation about, you know, the sexual politics and the dynamics of relationships and rape culture and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, responsibility lies on the man to ask. But, you know, the onus of responsibility at some point does fall on, you know, the man or woman receiving advances to say, I am uncomfortable with this.
I'm not interested.
You don't have to say thank you. You can just say no. No is always an option. Always. And I think there comes an...
Not to remove the legitimacy of real sexual harassment.
Obviously, I'm not...
Right.
I got a BA in sociology, guys. You don't get out of there thinking bass-ackwards things about the nature of sexual assault and unwanted sexual advances. That being said, I think... When you are two adults in a relationship, the onus of responsibility eventually falls to someone to say, I'm uncomfortable. At that point, you have made your feelings heard, and any recourse you choose to take is yours, you know.
Thereafter.
I think what Bobcat is getting at, Dustin, is the idea that we aren't communicating with one another. I think that is what he's saying. I don't think it is, because that's a scene that I think is easily misread as, you know, this angry white male fist in the air of emasculation in the face of women's liberation, and I don't think that's what Bobcat's saying at all.
No, it's a relational disconnect.
It's about
the
disconnect. It's about we're not having a conversation here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Frank, honestly, isn't having a conversation either. He's trying to make pleasantries with the receptionist, but he's not having a real conversation now. That falls on both of them, you know. Excuse me. I had tacos for dinner. I apologize. But I think that it's an interesting moment, this idea that we're not talking. And something that comes up again and again, like you talk about in the scenes, the soliloquies, and it's a lack of communication, I think, is what he's keying in on. It is, instead of talking to one another, we are deeply afraid of one another.
Yeah.
I think that's what he's getting. You're right, though. It's a problem.
It is. And it's a very interesting moment. And again, this film is totally valuable. I mean, don't take my evaluation as I didn't love it to say that there's no point in watching it. I probably would recommend it. But it's not a film I really loved, for whatever it is. But since we've kind of done our analysis and we've talked about
kind
our love or hate, let's do what we do. Let's do the shelf or trash, else or instead. Mm-hmm. Mr. Dalton Stewart, what say you?
I'm going to say put it on the shelf. I think Dustin's right. I think this is a very valuable film, you know, in many ways, just because you might not enjoy it particularly. Like, we didn't like Compliance in the slightest, but think it's one of the most important films we probably ever discussed on this show.
Yeah.
God Bless America, similarly, even if you don't particularly find the sense of humor funny, there are valuable things to take from it. There are important things being discussed. I think it's a good film. And, man, we could have done a whole episode on that office scene.
Yeah, we could have.
Damn, I'm still thinking about it, honestly.
It's good stuff. It's good stuff.
It's heavy loaded. Else or instead, I say else, double feature this with a little film called Heathers.
Oh, yeah.
From 1987, 88?
That is Winona and Christian Slater, right?
Yes, Winona Ryder, Christian Slater.
Oh, man, yeah.
It's basically, it's a perfect companion film to this. It really is. Two people disaffected with American culture, particularly American suburban culture, go on a murder spree.
in a dark comedy. I mean, it is as clear a double feature pick as you can make, and if you haven't watched Heathers, watch that damn movie. It's really good.
Okay, now my Christian Slater filmography is running together as mush inside my head, but that is the particular film in which he says, we need to go get a piece of pie because I love eating a piece of pie and talking about it after I watch a movie. Is it that movie?
I haven't seen it in so long, I don't know.
Dear listener.
I feel like, yeah.
Tell us.
Let us know.
The pie Christian Slater line. Do find it out. We could Google it, but we're not gonna. We're gonna give you the opportunity to let us know.
I'm just thinking, I love my dead gay son. One of the best, oh my god, one of the best lines come out of the 80s. Oh, it's hilarious. It's a funny movie.
It really is a funny movie.
I think that's a film that succeeds at this question of violence a little bit better. Mm-hmm. Oh my god, there's so many great, that's just a hilarious movie.
Excellent.
I've trailed off. Yeah, I'm in the ether now.
So I'm going to say shelf or trash, and I'm going to go ahead and say trash. I'm going to say not, again, trash in that I'm not putting it on my shelf.
Okay.
It's worth having.
I put it on the world shelf,
The shelf of planet Earth, yes.
I don't want to own it either, but
do I think it belongs in the Library of Congress? No. I don't think that preservation is necessary for it either when they do their important film.
How about a Criterion release?
No. Are you kidding me?
I don't know. This film might be hard to find after a while.
It probably will be. And it's micro-budget. I mean, it was on Netflix almost immediately after its release.
Yeah, shortly.
I think the actual run was less than 4 weeks. So I didn't look that up. I have no idea what the actual numbers are. But it was
It definitely did not get a wide release.
It was very, very short, and then it was on Netflix. So that gives you an idea of where it's making what little money it can from it. And that's not to say quality about the film at all. But I would say it's not great. What I'd say you ought to watch instead is Falling Down with Michael Douglas.
I actually like this movie a lot more though. Robert than Falling Down.
What?
Yeah. Yeah. I think
weigh in, dear listener.
I think Falling Down is problematic.
Yes,
I think it validates the rampage far too much.
No, because again, he doesn't know. He completely loses it, and realizes I'm the bad guy. I mean, that's the last line, or
that's
his last line.
That's true. That's true.
All right, well, I guess I would have got you with this fake Western draw scene.
That's a good movie, though. Yeah. I'm not saying it's a bad film. I just think it's definitely a solid Elsewhere Instead, though.
Yeah, and definitely within the same kind of social commentary, one man losing his mind and going violent. Mm-hmm. Another possibility I would recommend is a little film called Joe Versus a Volcano, where he gets a brain cloud.
We've talked about this before, yeah.
And I love Joe Versus a Volcano. I don't know why, but I do, because I probably shouldn't. Truth be told, it's
that good.
It's good trash for sure, with emphasis on the trash. But it's a lot of fun, and I like it. And of course, Tom Hanks is diagnosed with a terminal disease and goes out and he lives life, which I think might have been a more hopeful way for these encounters to have taken place and commentaries.
Well, much like Episode 9, probably Office Space. I mean, it's a very similar message.
Okay.
Instead of letting the oppression consume you, where you have to lash out against it violently, you simply leave. Walk away.
Do something else.
Exactly.
And so that, I think, because that's why I want to suggest something else, is because I think they should have done
something
else.
Fair enough.
And so that being said, I think it's good. I think you should see it. It's on Netflix. I don't know how long it will be there, because I don't know how long they can afford to keep it there. So catch it, and I would say catch it quickly. Let us know what you think.
Please do.
You can do that at facebook.com/goodtrashgenrecast. That's one word. I believe that's how Arthur says it.
I think that's how he says it.
I make my living through my words. It's a tragic moment.
Not everybody's perfect.
Well, moving on, we're going to do our game for the day, and we're going to begin with a discussion. Instead of doing what we typically do when we do these laundry lists of films, we're going to begin with a discussion of the transition from stand-up and other kind of comedy, live venue comedy, moving
improv,
into
sketch comedy, those fields.
Into cinema, and how certain comedians are able to do so and how others are not. We begin with the Goldthwait. I would just throw him out because he does something that is truly unique in that he has made the move to cinema, and I would say with less than amazing success. I mean, have you seen the Police Academy movies lately?
No.
they're not real funny.
Well, it's interesting, his career, the trajectory of his career, because it starts in, you know, the typical story of the working comic, you know, the not the household name, and doing comedy and getting bit roles in films, and then finding that you can't get work anymore, and then going back and doing stand-up. Oddly enough, he has this resurgence of creativity in himself that said, the hell with it, I'm going to make movies.
He's got a good directorial eye.
You know what, man, he's writing some movies. I hear some other films of his are quite good. I haven't seen anything else from him besides God Bless America.
I am unacquainted with the oeuvre.
I hear Father of the Year is exceptional.
Oh, that's Ron Williams flick, right?
Yes. Well, technically it's Bobcat Goldthwait flick. Written and directed.
Oh, well, yeah.
But yeah, Robin Williams. And again, another interesting look at this. Very good friends, if you don't know that.
Are they? Well,
they appear in a Snickers commercial together.
Well, I guess that makes sense.
But yeah, very, very good friends in real life. Well, did you notice that he shoots the guy from TMZ? And I love that the guy from TMZ is actually
a real guy from TMZ.
You know, good sense of humor about what he does, I guess.
I guess.
But he makes a joke about Robin Williams, and that's when when Frank turns around and shoots him in the neck. So, way to look out for your buddy, Bobcat.
That's kind of fantastic. I didn't know that. That's excellent. So, well, that's what we're going to do. We're going to talk about stand-up comics who make their way. I think one thing we might mention is the one waypoint it seems that many stand-up comics do.
Sketch and improvisation comics.
Do en route to the cinema is they stop through Saturday Night Live.
Through 30 Rock Plaza with Lorne Michaels.
And, I mean, just, you know, I think that, you know, Steve Martin,
Dan Aykroyd. Need to list them? I mean, yeah. No. Will Ferrell, Chris Rock, Tina Fey, Amy Poehler. I was working backwards, you were working forwards.
Starting where my frame of reference
Adam was Sandler, Chris Rock. I'm working backwards. Were you kidding me? I love classic SNL. Don't belittle me because I'm young. Old man.
Oh, shoot.
I take offense, good sir. Dustin, you ignorant slut. Yeah. See, talking to pop culture catchphrases again.
There you go.
It's a problem.
There you go. But what is it that gets in the way of that happening, and why does it happen so well sometimes and so poorly at others? What do you think, Dalton?
You know, it's an interesting thing. I think when you can look at people like Adam Sandler, who had really early success, not necessarily critically, although some of his films have been kind of critically lauded, his early stuff, Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore, even into films like Big Daddy, these are films that are very dumb, but have a certain wit about them.
Oh, they're funny.
Yeah. And then you watch this massive decline, and you see it with him, and you see it with, you know, to a lesser extent, Chris Rock. Chris Rock isn't shoveling out the same garbage. Typically, he's just kind of getting a paycheck, I think, to have basically... Eddie Murphy, that's a better example. I think Chris Rock is doing crappy movies so he can keep doing awesome stand-up, honestly.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting thing to watch, and I'm not really sure how it happens. I think it might be a sense of ego. I think it might be the loss of the immediate response from the crowd.
You know, maybe.
When a stand-up hones a half hour or an hour of comedy, you know, to be toured or then, you know, recorded on a CD or a DVD, you got to understand they're not pulling this out of their ass. This is shopped around clubs. This is shopped around the country. They spend a long time refining a half hour, an hour of comedy through understanding what works with the audience, what doesn't work, and then taking that and making it seem spontaneous and making it seem like a conversation is a one-sided conversation, but something that you, the viewer, are party to. You know, this is special for you. This is just for you. And I think that maybe when you look at some of these comics, they've lost that. That loss of the crowd response has negatively affected that ability to feed off the crowd and kind of call an audible of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
And go, okay, that didn't work, but that did.
By the way, that was a sports ball metaphor. I'm so proud of you.
I got a couple. My point is, I think there's something lost in translation. I really do. I think it stops being about saying something, and I think it starts being about money at a certain point, too.
True that.
Yeah. Because you look at the comics who have transitioned to the screen or to the, you know, to the silver screen or the home television, and I think, Louis C.K. specifically, who I'm thinking about, and Bobcat Goldthwait as well, it's less about money, although Louis C.K. is doing okay.
Yeah, he's making some money.
He's doing all right. My point is, though, it's less about money. It's still, I think it's still about saying something.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that might really be where I think the problem, I think that that might be the root of it. But also you look at guys like Judd Apatow, who has, you know, stayed behind the camera, started in stand-up, but stayed behind the camera, and is also trying to say something. His films vary in quality a lot of the time, but, you know, he's really, I don't know, I think it's an interesting thing. But then you look at Will Ferrell, who I think in many ways is the antithesis to Adam Sandler. Kind of a similar brand of stupid comedy, but I think Will Ferrell films, the particularly the ones he does with Adam McKay, they have a certain self-awareness to the stupidity. I'm thinking about Anchorman, much less Ricky Bobby. More like films like Anchorman and Step Brothers. They are very dumb, but there's a self-awareness and a surrealness and a crazy off-kilterness to them that I think is what makes it truly special. So I don't know. What are your thoughts on this, Dustin?
I think the directorial move is a different animal altogether.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when they move as actors, I think really the major problem for most of those who do that transition is they lack range.
Okay.
They really just lack range. And the ones who do very well are the ones who are the best at communicating some sort of range. And I think to myself, we'll go with Adam Sandler for just a moment, who hasn't done it as well. He's got angry and goofy, right?
Oh, yeah. I see what's going on here.
And what's wonderful is that all that sort of, you know, I love myself, I want to still seem kind of sweet, goofy, comes out of Punch Drunk Love, and he's just kind of angry and crazy.
That's really fantastic.
And it's a great performance, but it's really his other note.
You know, and I think maybe is it a possibility that it just hasn't been an attempt to stretch his wings a little bit? I mean, you think about films like Spanglish, I haven't seen it.
Mm.
I hear he flexes his acting muscle a little bit.
I don't know. I mean, having not seen Spanglish myself.
Other than the one where, God, what's that film? He's got another dramatic film. Like,
sure.
Who's the title of which escapes me. I think 9/11 factors into the plot somehow.
But
Rain Over Me. Ah, man, I'm good.
There you go.
So I don't know. I haven't seen a lot of his dramatic works, but I think.
But those with range, I'll name one that's less popular maybe, is Jim Carrey. Even in Liar Liar, those scenes with his son, there's a poignancy there, and there's a sweetness there. He's able to nail those moments, you know, without just softening his voice. And then he does great movies like The Truman Show. I like him a lot in The Majestic.
Eternal Sunshine
of the Spotless Mind.
Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, obviously.
Yeah. I like him quite a bit in the number 23, a Schumacher
that's a
film.
Terrible, terrible ass film, but it's kind of awesome.
It's kind of awesome.
It's camp. It's good trash.
It is good
trash. That's a campy movie.
That would be so much fun on this show.
Oh, my God.
If ever.
But yeah,
ever.
I think while his realm, I think Jim Carrey's experience doing stand up is limited. He definitely has a long history doing sketch comedy and doing improv. I mean, particularly his. You know, it's kind of his breakout role in, as the white guy on In Living Color. Yeah, I think that he's a good example. I think he's made some real stinkers.
Oh, sure he has.
But he doesn't crank them out with the frequency that Adam Sandler does. And I think there's more of an onus of responsibility, and I've been saying that word a lot. There's more responsibility falls on Adam Sandler because he's the producer of all of his films. He is the sole driving money and in a lot of ways creative force behind his films, and just keep getting worse and
they
worse.
They do.
Oh, my God.
The other actor I would mention is Robin Williams.
Yeah.
Who has definitely got range. Who's had Oscar-worthy performances.
I think his acting has surpassed the stand-up comedy in a lot of ways.
I think that's true.
Yeah.
I think that's totally true. And so, you know, and that's why he does so much better than, let's go in the same era, let's go with Billy Crystal, who is a great stand-up comic, who is a very funny guy, who's getting old now. I mean, we saw the Oscars a couple years ago. It was painful.
He's not looking great.
And no, he's not.
I think he's had some work done on the lips.
But he's only got one note. Ah! That's his note. And that's it.
Run that by me again?
No. I'm done.
Right. Okay.
But nah, hello. Right,
there we go. One more.
That's it. That's all he's got. You know.
Yeah.
And when he's not doing that, he's not doing anything.
Robin's got a lot of notes. Most of them. There's a very funny. Also on a podcast, there people went back and forth doing their best Robin Williams. And Bobcat was there, and Bobcat goes, "No, no, 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 no! Stop! You're doing it wrong.
You're doing the high energy Robin. That's not the real Robin. You gotta do it like this. Bob, what do you want me to do here? And there I go again doing terrible impressions on the show, but it was, Robin Williams was just fun. You know, he's definitely a, failed to rein himself in, I think.
At times. There are outrageous films. But even like Mrs. Doubtfire.
I'm not even thinking of his films. I'm thinking of like his live appearances. Stand-up or on just talk shows and such.
Yeah, he's pretty ridiculous. Yeah.
Dial it back, Robin. You're a funny guy. You don't got to reiterate the punchline to us. But I'm not here to critique him as a performer.
Mrs. Doubtfire, for example, is one of his great silly roles.
I freaking love that movie. I'm sorry.
And he does so well with his children. He does so well.
That's a touching film.
It really is. And it's all because of his acting chops.
Yeah,
and I think that's really it. Stand-up comedy is you are being you, and acting is not about being you.
It's about being someone else, yeah.
And so that's, I think, the big difference.
Yeah. But I think we're kind of wrapping this conversation up. I think we'd be remiss if we didn't name the end-all, be-all, comedian shifting to film, Woody Allen.
Kind
of the hallmark of
my goodness,
a stand-up
yes.
comedian shifting to the world of film. And that's something that a lot of people forget about.
Woody Allen was a stand-up guy.
He's a stand-up first. And that is something I think you can clearly see in his films, is something you see in God Bless America, is the voice of the auteur. I hate using that word, but it applies here.
I think it does.
Being directly thrown at the audience. It is not. There is no filter of the auteur's voice, and I think that is something that, as writers and as filmmakers, something comedians excel at, is not losing their voice, because that's what stand-up is about. It's about having a voice. I'm very burpy this evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's about having a voice. It's about saying something. It's about having an opinion and expressing that opinion in a thoughtful manner. And I think that is an area where, as filmmakers, comedians excel. Particularly, like we said, Woody Allen and Louis C.K. and Bobcat Goldthwait. I mean, guys who have shifted to writing and directing and do quite well at it.
So if we were...
Was it in God Bless America that we just watched where they joked about Woody Allen being a pervert?
Yeah,
I thought so.
There was a pervert joke there. That's fair. What I would say is this, is that dear Hollywood stand-up comics, SNL grads and others, I know you all listen to the show religiously.
Groundlings. UCBers.
Yeah, lend me your ears. What I would suggest to you is that you get behind the camera.
It seems to work out better for most. And I think at the end of the day, there is a certain amount of it being thrust upon them. Mm-hmm. I think in some cases.
Perhaps.
I think some would be more than happy to just, keep doing stand-up because that's their calling. But I think when you get so successful, hey, kid, you want to be in the pictures? I mean, it's hard to say no to that.
But if you want to do that, you're passionate about that, again, get behind the camera, help them write the script, and show other people how to be funny, and get your voice out there, as Dalton has very eloquently said.
Thank you.
Well, let's move on, and let's just talk about what's got us fired up this week in pop culture. Dalton, are you fired up?
I am. I'm fired up. I got two shorts and one long.
Okay, let's go.
All right. I was kind of waiting to... I felt like there might be a double entendre there. I got nothing. I'm tired. Well, first of all, today I found out, I think it was announced earlier this week, but today... shortly before we recorded this very podcast, I found out that Futurama has been canceled.
Oh.
Again. It's a sad day. Again. But you know what? It had a good run, damn it. I think it's an underappreciated show. I really do. I think it's every bit as good as its competitors in the, adult targeted comedic animations. Leagues ahead of Family Guy now. Early Family Guy is pretty solid, but it's leagues ahead of that. I haven't watched South Park in probably 4 or 5 years, but I mean, that show was kind of on the decline last time I watched it. The Simpsons has, passed its heyday, but still fairly smart. Futurama was, has its ups and downs, but overall, always a very intelligent show. Very self-aware, very wanting to say something about having a message, about using what sci-fi is great at, as a lens to look at ourselves through.
Sure.
And, it was a hell of a show. And it got, by the end of its run, 7 seasons and 140 episodes.
It's not bad.
No, that's a good run, especially considering they were canceled.
Mm-hmm.
Twice. They were canceled in 2003, 2004 from Fox. And then, thanks to reruns on, Adult Swim on Cartoon Network and Comedy Central, it kept the heartbeat alive. Kind of the same story of Family Guy.
Mm-hmm.
which was also canceled, picked back up by Fox. Futurama, you know, got picked back up by Comedy Central, and I've only watched a bit of their more recent stuff, but it remains strong. So it's sad to see it go, but you know what? Had a heck of a run.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't checked out Futurama, I recommend you do so. Secondly, I want to mention a little film that came up on our second episode where Dustin railed against the faculty. And that film is Pacific Rim.
Oh, okay. Well, that's my thing.
The trailer had been released on our second episode. And after we recorded, we feverishly watched it. We're very excited. Well, that comes out Friday. I'm seeing it Saturday. I'm super excited. Because you know what? What more could you want than one of the greatest living filmmakers today being handed a giant barrel of money to make a movie in which giant robots fight giant monsters? And it's not just any guy. It's a guy who actually cares about that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a guy who loves monsters and loves it when giant things fight each other. It's Guillermo del Toro, obviously. But I'll just tell you what, I'm really excited about that movie. I'm stoked. I read an article on IndieWire the other day ranking the films of Guillermo del Toro. Very, very good article. I recommend you search it out. It's rated from worst to best, obviously with worst being Mimic and best being Pan's Labyrinth. But,
right.
I mean, watch some Guillermo del Toro movies. Just do it.
Yeah, you should.
And go
right
see
now.
Pacific Rim. Because we need to support original ideas. Because it's not often a blockbuster is something that isn't based on something, a reboot of something, or a sequel.
A sequel.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Right.
But, you know, we got to have new stuff out there. Last but not least, I want to talk about a video game I finished between our meetings called The Last of Us. Developed by Naughty Dog Studios, published by Sony, exclusive to the PlayStation 3. It is a game that is being hailed as the Citizen Kane moment for gaming. And I will not go that far, because it is not innovative. However, it is an important moment in gaming, and Citizen Kane is held up because it is so innovative and introduced things that we still use today. The Last of Us is very much a culmination of the last 30 years of video games. And it is subtle for a video game. I mean, you know, which would not be subtle at all in the medium of television or film. But for a video game, it is damn subtle. It is the road meets... Actually, no, it's just the road. Only more colorful and more zombies, and imagine Viggo Mortensen stabbing more people in the face. But it is somber. It is heartfelt. It is full of really solid characterization and a moving story. And I think it has earned the hype that it's gotten. It is a fantastic video game that, while, like I said, I don't think it is groundbreaking in the way it's being said it is certainly the peak. And it's certainly a must-play title for anybody even vaguely interested in video games or for hardcore gamers. Seek it out, because it is a powerful game with a moral ambiguity that many films struggle to even try to achieve. So that's The Last of Us. And that's what I'm fired up about this week in pop culture. What about yourself, Dustin?
Well, you know, two things I'm fired up about. I guess maybe three. Well, let's go ahead and go with two. One of those is there's a French cinema festival going on at the Oklahoma City Museum of Art.
Ooh.
You know, if there was an elitist corner on this show, I would probably regularly contribute.
It would just be Dustin. Yeah. I mean, I'm interested, but I don't seek it out.
And so I'm into that, and so I may be catching a movie tomorrow night because I got a hot date with an amazing woman.
My wife?
Smoking hot wife,
okay,
that's right.
All
right. And so I'm kind of pumped about that.
It's not really a date if it's your wife, man.
It is a date, man.
Is that really?
Oh, yeah, because, yeah.
All right, I'll let you
Yeah,
know.
It's
really
date.
Just hanging out.
So there's that. The other thing I'm fired up about, or just want to, you know, mention as far as sort of a semi-listener response, is I got a phone call about my comments on Monsters U the other day.
Was it an angry phone call?
No, nothing like that at all. But
okay.
the concern was raised because I made a certain adult comedy reference to Animal House for the movie to make sure that it was kid-appropriate. And I want to say, and I actually echoed the words of Mr. Dalton Stewart, and I said, inasmuch as Scooby-Doo is, so is this. There is a humor level...
Did I say that?
You said something about Scooby-Doo. You did.
Cool.
In as much as there is this level of, how come Scooby and Shaggy always have the munchies... those sorts of over-the-head humor is present in the film, but it's not, you know, something that's just over the kids, inappropriate, where you're worried about your G audience. for the film. So there is that. And finally, and Dalton's already mentioned it, Pacific Rim.
No!
One of the major onuses for my...
we're using that word a lot tonight.
Step into film studies, because we say it. You say it, it's contagious. Words,
it's a good word.
Words are
it's
viral.
A good word.
Very, very early on in my writing about film career, I wrote a little paper on The Devil's Backbone. I also...
It's a good paper.
Written a little bit on some other films that he has
done.
Can
people read that on the internet anywhere?
It's not currently available.
We should post that. It's a good paper.
Okay. Well, I might get
it. Well, I saw your presentation and read the paper.
Well, that's a different deal. That's the Guillermo del Toro surreal paper. So
well, we should post both of them.
So afterward, maybe we could do that. But this is what I do want to say. Is this is a kaiju film. This is Godzilla.
Well, they're called kaiju in the film.
Right. And that's a genre from Japan. And it is Voltron meets Godzilla.
It's so awesome.
Listen. This is what I want to say to our dear listeners, mm-hmm. and this is what I keep telling myself. This is Voltron meets Godzilla. I know he directed Pan's Labyrinth. And I know he did the heartfelt and creative and quirky, weird Hellboy series.
He also did Blade 2, which is fucking great.
So did some very, very good stuff. But I want to say, this is a big budget, action, crazy movie,
mm-hmm.
okay? And it's going to be that. We're going to have soldier speak.
Have you seen the trailers?
I have.
Seems like he's going to get a little bit of his Del Toro weirdness, his surrealism, his interest in the human mind in there.
I think there's going to be some cool stuff, and it's going to be more, it's going to be better than a Godzilla movie,
mm-hmm.
better than Voltron the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I will say that. But I'm not, it's going to be giant robots smashing giant sea monsters through buildings.
But how awesome is that?
And that brings me to the final bit of my firing up, because I'm a little frustrated right now in pop culture. I got a little mini rant raising up in me.
All right.
You know what I'm sick of?
What's that?
Destroying cities.
I actually just before your rant goes on, I've had this similar rant. Guillermo del Toro has made a point of showing in this film that every time a kaiju is sighted and a Jaeger, which is the name of the giant, I'm sorry. It's so cool. This is globalism at its best. There's a Spanish filmmaker making an American blockbuster based on Japanese genres like
kaiju,
anime, and like the giant robots. And I'm not into anime, but I mean, it's clearly, I mean, the influence of the popularity of giant robots and giant monsters in Japan filtered through a Spanish filmmaker into an American giant blockbuster. But Guillermo del Toro has said that anytime they make a point of showing the movie, when the robots move to intercept the monsters, they evacuate the cities that they're going to be fighting in. Because Guillermo del Toro is a self-described pacifist. He doesn't want you to have to think about the people in those buildings. Something that I agree with Dustin is a major failure in basically every summer blockbuster that's had a big explosion-y action set piece.
Right. Well, and I haven't seen Man of Steel yet, but I understand
bad.
There's 40 minutes of just that.
They calculated the death toll and damage in dollars, and it's hundreds of thousands dead and hundreds of billions of dollars in damage.
I don't doubt it.
Like 30 9/11s in a row.
I believe that. And then I would also cite a movie much loved, a director much beloved by this podcast, The Avengers. But, I mean, okay, I realize 9/11 happened. Okay, I realize cities can be under attack. But I worry about perpetuating this culture of fear and this idea that there is no control, and out of nowhere, any moment now, everything can come crumbling around you. I mean, obviously those statements are true. I, of course, can be struck by a bolt of lightning any moment now also. But my culture does not force me to dwell on that possibility. And I find it a little disturbing, and frankly, I'm not real sure why we want to keep going and paying to see this happen.
Well, it's interesting. It's funny you bring this up, because actually, guest host of the show, Jeff Fuller,
mm-hmm.
And I recently had one of my last weeks at the University of Central Oklahoma. We had this very same conversation. We talked about this. And I agree with you, Dustin. I think it's problematic, and I think it's happening because we know what that looks like now, I think. I think we're revisiting that imagery because it is shocking. it is weighs on the senses. And now we know what happens when a building falls in a, you know, a major city. We know what that looks like in real life. But does that mean we should show it all the time? Probably not. I mean, first of all, it makes it lose its impact, which isn't good. And second of all, it's lazy.
Yeah.
You are hyping on real-world events to try to elicit a manufactured... It is blatant manipulation of your audience.
Right. It was just trying to get this emotional connection that, frankly, you should have already achieved
in
your character development and situation.
I'm going to defend Joss Whedon, because he does something that neither Star Trek Into Darkness nor Man of Steel do, which is show that our heroes are trying to get people out of harm's way, which is something that no hero in either of those films does, which I think makes them a terrible hero.
Yeah.
They're letting people, scores of people, die all around them. And that's just not good. That's not a good statement about our heroes of our culture, that they let worlds fall and crumble around them with a single-minded goal of defeating the villain. Now that's not... You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. I do.
I'm trying to be subtle, but not too subtle.
Yeah, I'm picking up what you're laying down.
And I agree with you. It's extremely problematic. And it's a good thing to be fired up about.
So, you know, that's what I want to say. I'm going to see this movie. I mean,
I still tip my hat to Del Toro and, to a lesser extent, Joss Whedon for, you know, making a point of allowing you, the audience, to go, okay, everybody got out.
Yeah.
Let's just watch some wanton destruction because everybody's safe.
Right.
For the time being.
I suppose. But this, again, it's something I see and it's a little unsettling.
I agree.
And upsetting, so it's upsetting.
It's upsetting.
It's totally upsetting.
I concur.
And so we move on now. Again, thank you so much for listening in, for tuning in, for checking out the Good Trash Genre Cast. By the way, we're not only available on Facebook, we are also available on Twitter.
We are available.
Where is that, Dalton?
Oh, we're available. You can find us. You might have to look in some seedier parts of town, talk to a racist who's going to bring a bunch of cases over to your motel room. Your compatriot's already left you. You found out that your relationship was a lie. She's gone back to be with her parents, who are actually normal and not, you know, crackheads and rapists. So you got to talk to some weird, seedy guy. He's going to give you this whole spiel. He's going to be kind of racist, say some very unpleasant things. But he's going to open a case, and in that case is something with which you can express yourself to everyone in the world. And that's Twitter. See, I told you, it's way easier when I just take a scene from the film and describe it with Twitter.
Right.
That we're doing. It's awesome. Ladies and gentlemen, you can find the Good Trash Genre Cast on Twitter at @good_trash. You know, we really love your feedback. We
really do.
And this is a film I'd like to hear what people have to say about.
And we've had a whole lot of other stuff that we've talked about on the course of the show. We'd like to hear what your favorite stand-up comic transitions to cinema are. We'd like to hear what you think about Smashing Cities.
Yeah.
And we'd like to also hear whether Dalton and I are right about how good or bad God Bless America.
And did you miss Arthur?
And did you miss
Arthur? We'll get rid of him. No, we won't.
And I'm going to say that...
Arthur, we're doing a new thing on the show that... we're doing this new thing on the show where once a month, one of us gets to pick a film, any film, similar to our Anything Goes marathon that we did recently. We're gonna bring that back once a month, and each month, one of your lovely co-hosts is going to pick a film that they present to the rest of the group, either at their delight or at their complete and utter dismay. Because July is the month of Arthur's birth. Arthur's birth. It's his turn. Arturo?
Auteur.
Auteur.
Auteur. Arthur.
Because it is, because July is the month of Arthur's birth, the first pick goes to him. And he's not here, but he texted us and told us what he wants to subject us to. And that film, the little film called Teen Wolf.
Little Michael J. Fox, gem from the 1980s. I'm kind of excited.
I had no idea that was streaming on Netflix.
I didn't either.
I got a rant about how racist this film is.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I cribbed it from crack.com, but they make some really good points, and we'll discuss it on next week's show.
Excellent.
So that's what we'll be watching. Teen Wolf!
Teen Wolf! So tune in on that.
Not Teen Wolf 2, thank God. Starring Jason Bateman, but the first one.
We will be seeing some amazing 80s fun goodness together, looking at the movie Teen Wolf, and we hope that in the time between now and then, you go out and catch a movie with somebody you like, get a piece of pie, yeah. and talk about it. And do tell us what Christian Slater movie that's from.
I have no idea.
I don't either. I know, I can see him saying it, but I can't remember who the
actor. Are you sure it's Christian Slater?
I'm almost positive.
I feel like it might be True Romance. Christian Slater's in that movie.
Yes.
But I think it might be True Romance, and that was not him, but that was a guy who's a male lead in that film. Well, it's not David Arquette, because his sister's the lead. Maybe it is Christian Slater.
I don't know. Let us know, dear listener. We refuse.
We are completely stumped.
And we refuse to Google it.
No.
So
we're trying to do this in one take.
We're going to have... No, we refuse to Google it even after. We want the conversation to go on. So look it up and let us know. And so we are on embargo for that. But until next time, we'll see you then. And in the meantime, go watch a movie. And we'll see you after we watch TV.